Hi there, I'm Liz Riley, and this is the April 2018 Accountancy Ireland podcast. Coming up today, we are talking GDPR, IP, security, and how it might affect your organization. With me today are Peter Bolger, Head of Intellectual Property, Technology and Privacy at LK Shields, Neil Tierney, Director at Tierney IP, and Gavin Doherty, Managing Partner at 247 Meetings. Thank you very much for being here, guys, today. To start off, for the listeners who don't know, and that I think would be incredible, but you never know, what is GDPR? What are we looking at right now that's coming in on the 25th of May? Is that correct?
That's correct.
25th of May. What is it compared to what current legislation is, and what is it that organizations have to do, essentially, in the next 40-something days?
Sure, it's ambitious with 40-something days to go, but maybe if we start with what we have at the moment. So at the moment, we have the Data Protection Act 1988 and 2003. So essentially, we've had some sort of data protection way back since 1988. So in a sense, it's not new. But our current law is based on a European directive from 1995, and it was seen to really have fallen out of date over that period of time. If you think about it, it predates smartphones, even or widespread internet usage. So the European Commission decided in consultation with the member states to codify data and update data protection regulation in the EU. And that has led to the GDPR, or the General Data Protection Regulation. And that brings about a few fundamental changes that companies and businesses are grappling with at the moment before this deadline of the 25th of May.
Is this all companies and businesses?
Correct.
Right.
In terms of what it does, there are certain principles of data protection that we have at the moment, and the GDPR doesn't really affect those. They continue in full force. So rights like you have to be transparent and fair, you shouldn't collect data that's excessive. All of these principles continue in full force and effect and are really untouched. But where the GDPR is bringing in new rights and obligations, and it's always important to bear in mind that the GDPR is seen as a piece of fundamental human rights. So there's a corporate perspective and there's the data subject perspective to how you look at the GDPR. But there's some new rights. So under Article 30, all companies, with some very few exceptions, have to keep records of all data processing that they take, that they carry out in their business. It brings in two new principles. One, privacy by design, which quite simply is if you're building a new product or service, you have to bake in the data protection principles in an effective manner prior to the launch of that. So you really have to think of privacy day one. It brings in privacy by default. That's simply, I suppose it's an extension of the principle of data minimization. So it prompts you to stop, go, we're developing a new product or service. How can we do this collecting the minimum amount of data that's necessary to achieve the goal or the ambition with that product or service? A couple of other things it's put on a statutory footing that kind of exists now but aren't formal. The first of those would be a data protection officer. So you'll have seen and we'll have all noticed that a lot of companies have privacy officers or someone that's designated to look after privacy. But what the GDPR brings in, and this is maybe something we'll touch on later, is this principle of someone who is a designated role within an organization that's regulated by the GDPR that looks after privacy and GDPR compliance within that organization. Privacy impact assessments. This is something that a lot of people have heard about, but maybe to spend a minute demystifying that. At the moment, if you were to develop a new product or service, it would be wise but not mandatory to carry out a privacy impact assessment, which is, okay, we want to build this product or service. How do we do it? How do we bake in data minimization? And how do we make sure that from the view of the data subject, that we're not going too far? And that's an assessment that's carried out. But the GDPR says it's all well and good that you may do that ad hoc at the moment. But if it involves high-risk processing, then in those circumstances, and the GDPR spells out a few circumstances that are always high risk, then you must carry out a privacy impact assessment. Two other things to briefly mention, because I think it's really useful. It brings in a right to be forgotten, which is completely, in my experience, misunderstood as to what that is. A lot of people think it's the right to rewrite history, which it isn't. And of course, there's a lot of talk about data portability, which has implications for things like intellectual property. But if I finish with the introduction with one fundamental point that is the big takeaway, and that is it brings in an accountancy principle. So the fact companies have been dealing with data protection, as I say, since 1988, but really, have you gone about, you know, having a file in your office that explains how you've gone about complying with the Act? Probably not. And what the GDPR does, and this is possibly its fundamental obligation on all companies, is that you must be able to demonstrate compliance. So if, for example, the Data Protection Commissioner were to come into your office for some reason, say for an audit, it's not simply enough to declare compliance. You will have to actually demonstrate how in each case you have met your obligations under the GDPR. And that's probably, that accountancy principle is probably what flips it on its head and what's causing everyone to look at it before the 25th of May.
I think it's interesting that's where you ended that introduction to GDPR, because it kind of is a follow-up. It's a good follow-up is, how is this affecting businesses? That's work. That's a lot of work. And I think you all are part of different businesses. How is that affecting your businesses, and how will that affect on a greater scale? I don't even know how you go about proving that in each and every case you have been compliant.
Sure. And this is a question we're often asked, and in particular, is the obligation the same on a large company as it is on an SME? And of course, you know, within that scale, you're considering the cost of the implementation of the GDPR as well. There is a bottom line cost. But again, that has to be flipped on its head in a certain way, that this is fundamentally human rights for data subjects. Therefore, it's coming from that angle. How do you start and how do you go about it? Well, I would give some comfort in the fact that we at LK Shields, like any other business, have to comply ourselves. So we have an internal GDPR program working up to be compliant by the 25th of May, no more than any other organization. But how do you go about it? Well, we advocate what sounds like three simple steps, but you're quite right, it does sound like a lot of work. So we say there's probably three basic stages to compliance. One is, and I think of this of a pipe into a business and a pipe out of the business. So data mapping is essentially trying to figure out what personal data you're collecting and is coming into your organization. What do you do with it when you have it? And at the other side, where is it going? Who are you sharing it with? Is that documented? Is that appropriate? If you've done a data mapping exercise, which, you know, can be tailored to each level of compliance that's required of an organization, you probably then do a gap analysis. So once you know what you actually have and you're processing and you're sharing, you would then, you could even use a simple traffic light system. You can map that against what you're supposed to be doing under the GDPR. So everyone's going to have red flags. This is non-compliant. There's going to be ambers, and if you're good behavior for over the past number of years, you're going to have some green slots as well that don't require change. But using that traffic light system, and it can be far more sophisticated than that, but to give a straight example, you would then determine what is it we as an organization need to change. And that stage is called remediation. And that is, what processes do we have to change? What policies don't we have that we should have? A simple thing, do we train our staff on GDPR and what to do with personal data? But those three steps, which can be cut up and tailored for any particular client, regardless of who's assisting them or if it's being carried out internally, help you get a handle on what you have. But the starting point we find in practice is, what do we have and where is it coming from and where is it going is fundamentally the key question.
You guys finding that in your own businesses that this is burdensome at all?
Yeah, I'll certainly chip in with a few questions and comments there. Our company 24/7 meeting, we've got quite a simple, in terms of the data mapping that you mentioned there, Peter, ours is quite simple. We have our customers' emails, sometimes we have their phones, and we know where they work. So we've no idea in terms of, say, their political preferences, their age, their height, their weight, you know, all that kind of stuff, which seems to be quite topical at the moment, particularly political preferences. There's a certain amount of burden that we are coming up to scratch with, and we are, you know, between now and May the 25th, there are things that we want to introduce on our website specifically. So yes, there's a certain amount of burden, but it is something that we've looked at for a long time. We've often wanted to, what we say to people in plain English is that, look, we take your email, sometimes your phone number, but that's as far as it goes. We're not going to send those to anybody else, we promise. But I think in some ways the GDPR coming down the tracks at us is forcing us to actually go beyond just a, hey, we promise that, to actually put it up on our website and say, this is the process, this is the information we have on you, and here's what you can do with it, and effectively to be able to say to our customers, this is your data, not ours, and the control of it rests and formally, with you, the data user or the end person. Now, that said, there is some overhead. So I did have a question for you, Peter. What you described there, say, so, you know, having to demonstrate compliance, could demonstrating compliance largely be done for a smaller organisation like ours? Could it be largely done by, say, somebody looking at our website and signing up for a free trial and then just seeing, you know, what information we hold on them, what information they put into our system? And could compliance be demonstrated effectively at arm's length?
Yeah, sure. So to just maybe take that front end that you're talking about, where you inform the user or the customer that this is the data that we're collecting. I suppose you're demonstrating compliance in that sense by having considered the GDPR, applied the GDPR to what you're collecting, and you have a policy that they're informed of, or a statement that this is how your data is going to be collected. So that in and of itself is demonstrating compliance, because you will have gone through that process. Further things that you can assist in terms of data, you know, demonstrating compliance could be, we've trained our staff. They know our data protection policy. They themselves are subject to terms about data handling in terms of, say, internal segregation of data. Perhaps not everyone needs to have access to that data. And you might have a document in the background that has considered these issues in terms of it. But, like, I mean, your starting point is very well made there in terms of the front end and demonstrating to the end user, data subject, as we call them in legal terms, which is just simply the person about which the data relates. So that will be it. For other companies that are collecting more data, or perhaps are using tracking cookies on the internet and things like that, there may be more of a back-end analysis that they have to do to show, this is why we collect the data, this is why we have the data. And other things as well come into it, like, this is how long we retain the data. And that's been an issue for the Irish Data Protection Commissioner for a number of years, is data retention. Like, I mean, if there's a rule of thumb that's applied in Ireland, it's keep data just in case. In turn, that's just not good enough under the new regime that we face now.
Just wanted to ask you, Peter, you know, we talked about the sort of the front end steps that we need to take in order to comply with GDPR. To what extent do you see a very well drafted privacy policy is important? You know, when people go onto your website and they look at your privacy policy, to what extent is that important, or what do businesses need to do in order to look at their existing privacy policies and
perhaps amend them? Yeah, it's a good question, Neil, because as I said at the outset, data protection itself is not new. So loads and loads of people have data protection notices or policies in place for years that set out this information. But what's important to know in the context of that question, Neil, is that the GDPR says probably you have to go further than what people naturally have done to date to comply with the law. And it sets out certain criteria that those data protection notices or policies must fulfill. So what does that mean in practice? What that means in practice is that you consult your lawyer or your consultant or whoever's advising you, or perhaps it's internal. You'd cross-examine your current policy against those requirements set out in the GDPR and go, is that sufficient? Now, in our experience, it's almost always not sufficient. So you have to 2.0, as we call it, the privacy statement, our notice. So to give you an example, now at the moment, you might just call out in a notice or policy, we collect the following data, but you probably should, under GDPR, say, we do this and this is the legal basis upon which we hold it. And that could be, you've given us your consent to hold it. That could be a legitimate reason. It could be, we're holding this data pursuant to a contractual relationship, as in, to perform the contract with you, we need to process the data in this particular manner. And in that case, you'd want to be evidencing the legal basis as well, which probably hasn't been done that much to date. And also the GDPR requires that you call out in your notices or policies that data subjects have certain rights, like the right of access, and things like that. So again, this is why I always say is if you look at it purely from a corporate perspective, it almost becomes a compliance cost issue, whereas the thrust of the GDPR is about not only creating obligations on company, but creating on companies, but creating rights for the individual. So in that sense, there's absolutely two aspects to it.
Would I be correct in saying, Peter, that under the existing legislation, when it comes to right of access, I think if you receive a data access request, you're entitled to charge a minimum charge. But am I correct in thinking that under the new GDPR regulation, you're not entitled to charge unless the cost is excessive?
Neil, you're spot on. I suppose two observations on that. Currently, you are allowed to make a charge. And certainly for any of our listeners that have gone through a subject access request, they're now probably currently having a chuckle to themselves because it's just over €6.
I was about to say, wasn't it very low?
And certainly for anyone who's used outside assistance to comply with the subject access request, they know that is absolutely disproportionate to the effort that's involved. You're absolutely correct, Neil, in the sense that the GDPR, except in exceptional circumstances, doesn't take into account of any charge. But in that sense, in Ireland, it doesn't make that huge a difference because it was never going to cover the cost in any event.
Yes, of course.
Neil, Peter brought up right to access, and there's also right to portability. When it comes to intellectual property, say, for example, you have... someone has some tech and then someone requests their information and they are required to give that information over to them, but also in a format that they will be able to transfer onto something else. They will be able to open it up in another way so they can transfer. Is there issues with intellectual property and IP there? You could be giving stuff away about your own system, stuff away meaning information about your own system that might... Is there a conflict there?
There may well be issues in so far as some forms of intellectual property, by that I mean sort of unregistered forms of intellectual property protected by, for example, means of non-disclosure agreements. So that's where I would see perhaps a slight conflict is if there is something covered by a non-disclosure agreement which falls within the umbrella of personal data, and then there's a request to transfer that over. Where's the, you know, you've got two
where's
conflicts.
The line?
But where's the line? You've got two conflicts, one between the non-disclosure agreement and of course, GDPR. Now, I would argue that I think probably GDPR, I don't know if Peter agrees, but GDPR would probably trump that, and you may well be required to transfer, for example, if a data subject requests access to their data, and you may well be required to transfer that over, even though that might have been covered in a non-disclosure agreement, if that makes sense. Yeah.
What I'm also curious about in that area is if, I mean, there's people's ideas and there's security around that.
Mm-hmm.
If there's information that you have, there's right to access.
Yes.
Is it possible for that to now get out? And do businesses have any recourse, or do you think businesses have any recourse when it comes to wanting to keep, obviously, their ideas under privacy?
I think in those situations, you'd have to adopt an exercise where you try and determine, well, what can I provide access to? Certainly, I think insofar as it's personal data, you will have to do that. But I think you may be able to filter out, well, then other confidential information from that.
But do we know yet?
But yeah, that's the difficulty, is trying to determine, well, where do you draw that line?
What conflicts are businesses running into when they're prepping and then ultimately having to implement new workflows? And how might those issues affect their customers and clients? Gavin, you have clients and they might be having an exchange of ideas. Is this right to access and right to your own information, how is that affecting your clients? And how are you guys looking at it to make sure that they will stay, I suppose, safe, and I'm putting that in quotes, or secure?
Yep. I'll answer you obliquely to a certain extent. We have a challenge in that to interact with our system, the typical is that people dial into a phone number and they put in a PIN code and then they're talking on their meeting with people in, you know, London, Luxembourg, whatever. one of our challenges that we're looking at with GDPR is that, in theory, one of our existing customers can say, hey, I don't want you to keep my phone number. I want you to forget it. That's one. Now, we need to be able to keep track to invoice them, to bill them, and that kind of where we're approaching, say, the level of how our system works. And if they say to us, oh, I want to use your service, but, you know, not make a phone call into it, we kind of have to stop and go, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, if your privacy is so sensitive that you can't make a phone call into it, and if you can't organise to, say, use a phone that shows an anonymous number, we will struggle to help. so there are, now that's, I guess that's one of the hard cases that makes poor laws. In general, most people accept that, you know, fine, if I'm going to be using the service, well, of course, you know, that to be billed back on it, then people will be able to see what calls I made. We have a similar kind of nugget, which or a challenge that Peter might be able to give me some input on, in the sense that we have, again, we take people's email addresses and we use them for, say, system notifications. So say we have 100 dial-in numbers all over the world, and those dial-in numbers come from 40 or 50 different telephone companies. So we'll deal with, you know, AT&T in the States, we'll have Orange in France, we'll have BT over in the UK, that kind of thing. Sometimes one of our carriers, like, say, as an example, in Italy, Telecom Italia, their number goes down for an hour. Now, we want to be in a position to be able to offer a reliable service, that if there are issues with our service, which rarely happens, thank goodness, but if our partners have issues, we want to be able to communicate with our existing users and say, hey, listen, there's an issue in Italy, please use an alternative number. Now, we're not quite sure exactly how to do this. If somebody says to us, well, look, I don't want you to be communicating with me, or I don't want you to use my email address for anything other than, you know, the invoicing, we're not quite sure exactly where to put that kind of nugget, or how to crack that one.
And I imagine there's many companies in the same position now.
I would have said
not
so.
Not specifically, but...
Yeah, I mean, the classic would be, say, a retailer that's shipping stuff out and somebody somewhere has checked a box saying, please don't call me by phone, because understandably, they don't want to be bombarded by the previous experience of hundreds of non-related retailers or offers or whatever being directly marketed at them. But if it's, hey, your parcel's gone missing and I can help you find it, do tell us how to get around that.
You didn't know you were being called in for advice today.
No, there we go. We'll send our fees letter after, don't worry. Look, there's a couple of points in there, and maybe to deal with them, with the first one first, which is the right to be forgotten. If there's anything that, just from our feedback from the market, that's clear, is that there's a complete misapprehension or misunderstanding as to what that is. You know, the GDPR doesn't provide a fundamental right to a data subject to simply declare that their data be deleted. To give an example, someone leaves an employer, they can't the next day sort of write back and say, rewrite history in the sense of deleting me from your records.
And so, I think a lot of people think that is what it means.
And I think a lot of people post 25th of May are going to get this correspondence saying, please do it. So that's going to be interesting of itself. The other aspect about email communications. So this it's great that the opportunity has come up to clarify that, because the regulation of email, or direct marketing by email or SMS, or for those of us that still have them, fax machines, that's regulated by the e-privacy directive, okay, as implemented in local laws. So our legislation goes back to 2011. That e-privacy directive was supposed to be upgraded and updated at the same time as the GDPR, but it hasn't happened. There's been a delay. So nothing really is changing that much on sort of where's the line in terms of communications with customers. But I think as a rule of thumb, the way you can operate is that it's more than likely okay to communicate by email or SMS, for that matter, in urgent cases where it's a service communication. So it's part and parcel of the service that you've subscribed for. I'm letting you know your parcel has now left the depot. I'm letting you know the Italian telephone number is down. Please use this alternative email address. What's less clear is if those service messages stray into direct marketing. Okay, and you don't need me to express a view on what the legal definition of direct marketing it is. If there's one thing I have, I know everyone has their own sense of what direct marketing, you know it when you see it. So if a service message were to creep into the area of direct marketing, that's where you might have a little bit of a different issue. So, hey, line down, but by the way, we have this other great product over here. Or it could be pure direct marketing to the same people. I want to let my database of customers know something. That's more regulated. And to be honest, if you get it wrong, it's not seen as anything different to spam. Just those random things that you might get into your inbox. And the general requirement, and I won't get into too much detail here because it gets a little bit complicated, but the general requirement is if you want to direct market by email or SMS, then you need opt-in consent. So you can't infer it or you can't assume it. You need a little box or something equivalent ticked somewhere that says this person accepts direct marketing. Now, there's grey areas around the edges of that rule that you can play with in practice, but that's the fundamental rule. So it's good to bring up that distinction.
So on consent then, this is something that's come up in our discussions internally. Like every small company, we do a certain amount of direct marketing, not enough in, as the CEO, not enough in my opinion, plenty in our customers, I'm sure. The issue of consent has come up, and can we infer or assume that our existing customer base has consented, or is it enough to, and I've seen some of these communications coming through, just send each person an email saying, this is how we view your current status.
Sure.
You have consented, but give your choice to
update. I think the legal principle of qui tacit consentire, silence doesn't give consent, probably is not appropriate for GDPR.
Look, your privacy notice that we touched on earlier is going to be explaining to your data subjects, your customers, what you're doing with their data, right? So that's compliance with the GDPR. But if you want a direct market to a database, it goes back to this principle of opt-in consent, right? So you might have to explore the fringes or the edges of that rule that I mentioned. So for example, there's something called a soft opt-in. Okay, and very simply, a soft opt-in is that if you're dealing with an existing customer and it's within a period of 12 months and they haven't opted out, okay, but they haven't opted in either, but they haven't opted out, then in those circumstances, you can bring to their attention your own company's similar goods and services in relation to it. So there is some wriggle room when it comes to your own customers. Now, you have to, if you have a database of 20,000 contacts, you need to know where everyone falls into. But if it's a customer database, that could give you flexibility in terms of it. But each time that you want to go with a campaign, as I say, this is not pure GDPR. We have it already. You do need to know what's in your database and on what basis they're receiving the communication.
You brought up, obviously, direct marketing, and you know it when you see it. We get a lot of direct marketing, but what happens when personal data is being transferred outside of the EU?
I had to deal with this issue recently on behalf of a client outside of the EEA. Peter, I'm sure, will jump in here. Insofar as in certain circumstances, you can transfer data outside of the EEA, the European Commission has what are called adequacy decisions. So there are a list of countries to which you can transfer data. These are countries where the EU says, right, well, they have more or less the same forms of protection as in place as we do in the European Union. Now, outside of those, I think it gets a little bit more difficult, and you're straying into areas like standard contractual clauses, and I'll defer to Peter on this because it's not my area familiarity.
You're quite correct, Neil. So if it's a whitelisted or approved third country, then transfers are generally permitted, and the European Commission maintains a list of those countries. If the export outside the EU, or as the GDPR and current law says, the EEA, if there's any transfers out, you need to look at where the export is going. So, for example, if it's to a whitelisted country, it's fine. In the alternative, if it's going to the US, we will all have heard of Safe Harbor, are now replaced with the Privacy Shield. So that might be an option in respect of the US. And in most other cases, a lot of group companies might have binding corporate rules and things like that to permit sharing of data across the group. But the far more common way to do it is via the model clauses or standard contractual clauses. And these are, this is where the, like, I mean, the law has made it a little bit easy for us, which is good, in the sense that the European Commission has issued forms of model clauses or contracts that you can use, and you just need to tailor them to the appropriate circumstances. But in essence, it's the basis to do it. I think we've seen in the press over a number of weeks that there can be, despite the legal papering exercise that might be done, there might be still some sort of a mismatch in terms of expectations of what might happen in your data, but the legal mechanisms are there. So fundamentally what the SECs do is extend your European rights and protection beyond the borders of the EEA to that third country.
I think that's a very significant aspect of GDPR, is its extraterritorial reach in so far as it's going to impact on businesses that hold data on EU, I don't even like to say national, because I don't think that's part of the regulation. It's anybody who is resident in the EU. So if their data is being held outside, this is where GDPR will have a significant impact, and certainly insofar as fines are concerned. And
Well, obviously, right now we have, I mean, in the news, there's the issue of Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, but you have tons of big companies that hold data all over the world. They're possibly based in the United States, but then they also have European headquarters. What happens in cases like that?
They will be monitored and regulated by the supervisory authority in the country where they have their main establishment. So, you know, there will be, I think that's correct, Peter. So insofar as the extraterritorial reach is concerned, what I was thinking about were these companies that don't have any presence in the European Union. And I think that there may well be difficulties there in terms of, well, how do you enforce GDPR on those countries? For me, it's a query that I'm still trying to get my mind around.
Can't be the only one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like a Chinese website in Alibaba.
That has no substantial presence in the European Union, but yet that Chinese website happens to be, as Peter mentioned earlier on, monitoring the behavior of people who are in the European Union. How is GDPR going to be enforced against such a company? I don't have an answer to that.
It's a valid question. And what we're seeing in practice, just to give one example, is some companies established outside of the EU that have some nexus with the EU for the collection of personal data, their actual customers are expecting them to be GDPR compliant. Right, so it's coming up just through what people's expectations when they're doing their own GDPR compliance program. They're going, hey, you collect stuff for us. Are you GDPR compliant? The other thing is, but it doesn't answer your question, Neil, in terms of the enforcement, is that if you fall into this category, you're supposed to appoint an EU representative to deal theoretically with the supervisory authorities. But that in itself doesn't address Neil's issue insofar as it doesn't say necessarily, and this will come out in the fullness of time, that representative is somehow liable or must somehow implement the GDPR themselves. It's more a representative status. But that in itself has tricky questions about if you act as an EU representative, are you personally liable if the entity outside the EU is non-compliant, issues of that nature. So that'll only come out in the fullness of time. But internationally, there's awareness of GDPR, but I'm not sure a lot of companies realize it might actually apply to them.
I think Mark Zuckerberg made it very clear yesterday that he's very aware of GDPR.
Yeah. That's true.
Finally, let's just wrap up. What can businesses do to make sure they are compliant? Is there any quick, dirty tips that we can give right before we go?
Well, I think I think there's a few types of company in the Irish market that we're seeing. We're seeing the model students, those ones that, you know, we're all at the back of the class studying away that we went to school with, who are approaching or have completed their GDPR program. There's others that are like 50, 75% of the way. And then my best guess is there's a whole bunch of people out there that are going, gosh, this is coming up. Is there something I should be doing? In terms of easy kills, like, I mean, having external facing policies, things like that, at least having considered those would be good. But I'd also recommend that you start, even if you don't, you're not going to hit the 25th of May, which is probably ambitious if you're starting now.
If you don't hit the 25th of May, are there penalties? If you don't have a data compliance officer by the 25th of May.
Sure, and you need one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, there could be consequences, and the GDPR does expressly provide for some scary sounding fines.
Very scary sounding fines.
You know, so in that regard, but in terms of it's not Y2K. It's not the 25th of May, you're ready, you're not ready. Okay, I'll speak for myself as remembering Y2K when we're expecting all the airplanes to fall from the sky, which thankfully didn't. But this is an ongoing process, right? It starts the 25th of May. People ask, is there a grace period? Well, we've been in the grace period for 2 years. So the grace period ends on the 25th of May, just to clear up that myth. But I certainly think all is not lost in terms of if you could take some easy kills. But I would start your process now if you haven't, on the basis that in terms of if you were audited or for some reason you came to the attention of the Data Protection Commissioner, could be a data breach might happen that brings you to someone's attention. Who knows? But it would be better if you're under investigation or under an audit that you've started this process than simply sat idly by. In terms of that, it's not an express factor set out in the GDPR in terms of calculating fines, and we have no idea how regulators are going to approach how they calculate fines, other than we all know what the headline figures are. But they are allowed in figuring out if there's a fine to be issued and what that level of fine should be to look at mitigating factors. And I can only assume that those that are in the middle are at least making substantial efforts to be compliant, even if they haven't hit the 25th of May, that's going to be a factor. Or to flip it on its head, if you've done nothing, that's not going to be necessarily a positive thing.
Yeah. That's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Peter, Neil and Gavin for being with us and lending their opinions and expertise. For anyone looking for more information for yourself or your clients on GDPR, you can check out the new data protection update that was recently published by the Institute. If you get in touch with Dylan Conway at 01-637-7241 or email him at dylanconway@charteredaccountants.ie. Thanks for listening and bye for now.
Today's podcast was recorded by Tin Pot Productions. The producer is Daryl Morehouse and the series editor is Liz Riley. This programme is published by Chartered Accountants Ireland.